You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, White House officials in early discussions about President Biden taking a trip to Europe as Russia's assault on Ukraine only escalates. The U.S. now calling on China to put pressure on Putin to end the war. This is Instagram goes dark across Russia. The Russian government has now cut off access to Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We'll examine how the digital Iron Curtain is impacting everyday Russians. And China dealing with a crisis of its own. Hong Kong facing the worst COVID outbreak since the pandemic began. China the worst since Wuhan in 2020. Why the technology behind the vaccine most widely used in China may be failing. Russia's promised ban on Instagram has now kicked into full effect, with a social media platform inaccessible for the vast majority of the country's population. I want to bring in Bloomberg's Kurt Wagner now for more on this. Kurt, you know, what does this exactly mean for everyday Russians, given that Facebook and Twitter have already been cut off?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we're moving towards a relatively dangerous spot here, right? Where suddenly Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, these are services that were really connective tissues between the Russian people and obviously the rest of the world. In a crisis like this, it's where a lot of people could get information and news that wasn't directly kind of approved by Russian state-backed media. And so, you know, you look at what's happening now and you wonder, are we ever going to get back to this, right? Is this maybe the beginning of Russia is kind of looking a little bit more like China with a closed version of the internet? And I don't know what happens after this, but obviously it's a pretty significant deal. Russia's a lot smaller than China from a total population and user perspective, but it's a really big deal just symbolically of what this means and what this might look like moving forward.
Absolutely. China blocking Facebook and Twitter around the Beijing Olympics in 2008 and never unblocking it. Right. So you wonder if that's what's going to happen here. I'm curious, in Russia, how widespread are the use of VPNs and other means to get around the firewall? Is that common?
Well, it's the kind of thing that companies are trying to make accessible, right? I think we saw last week that Twitter, for example, created a version of its website for the Tor browser so that if anyone wanted to kind of get around this ban, they might be able to. They might be able to kind of use the quote-unquote dark web to access these services. But Emily, that's not the kind of thing that's necessarily accessible to the vast majority of people, right? That's for people who are pretty tech savvy. That's for people who are really going above and beyond to try and figure out how to still keep these services in their life. The vast majority of people, you know, unless they can simply get it on their phone, it means they're not going to have access to it. And so I think that this is something that, to your point, like, are we seeing the beginning of a major change here that might not be rolled back? And I think the answer might be yes.
We're also seeing some major changes from the platforms themselves. Facebook, for example, relaxing the rules to allow Ukrainians to talk about violence in the context of Russia's war on Ukraine. And that's really what seemed to trigger the Russian government. Instagram was a place a lot of people had turned to protest the war in Russia. Where will these Russian citizens go to next? What social media outlets are available to them?
Well, the one service that continually keeps getting brought up is Telegram. Now, I don't know if that's the kind of place where people will be able to organize in the same way or to promote things publicly in the same way. You know, it is a private messaging app, obviously similar to WhatsApp, Telegram. There are groups, there are ways to broadcast that way, but it has a different vibe, Emily, as you know. And so I think, you know, you talked about what the platforms are doing. I mean, the Instagram thing in particular was announced by Russian regulators after Facebook came out and said, hey, Ukrainians are able to call for violence against Russian soldiers. And they said, you know, this is a company basically allowing, you know, people to attack our citizens. That's what the Russian regulators are saying. And again, I think that it just has kind of snowballed here, the relationship between Meta and Russia and the Russian leaders. And I just don't really know where we go from here.
What does this mean for Meta and Twitter, you know, two companies that obviously their growth depends on new users and new ad revenue?
So Meta said something interesting at the end of last week. Not a lot of people saw it because it was at one of those private banking conferences. But their CFO said that the ad revenue that they get either from Russian businesses or that's targeted at Russian users is 1.5% of their total advertising revenue. So while obviously that's not nothing, it's not insignificant, it's also not a massive business for Meta. And I bring that up because when you look into the future and you say, well, is this the kind of thing where Meta is going to bend over backwards to try and get back into Russia? I don't know if they're going to be willing to do that for such a small portion of their business, right? They don't have the financial incentives necessarily to make concessions in the way that they might in other parts of the world. And so that to me is one of the many reasons why I find this kind of you know, digital iron curtain you were talking about interesting, because I don't know if there's enough people in Russia for these companies to feel like they can compromise on some of the other parts of their policy that they've so far stood firm in support of.
Meantime, Mark Zuckerberg making a surprise appearance at South by Southwest later this week. My guess, obviously, all of these topics are going to be on the agenda, but of course, the metaverse and his vision for the future. What do you make of Zuckerberg, who really hasn't been doing a lot of press, getting out front?
Yeah, I think I heard this was his first time at South by since something like 2010 or something like that. It's certainly been a very long time since he'd appeared at this particular conference and really a conference like this. Now, he's doing it with sort of a familiar interviewer, not someone who's, you know, necessarily in the news industry who's going to sit there and grill him about all of the stuff that we were just talking about. So I do wonder how substantive the interview will be in terms of news about policy and world happenings. But for him, it's a way to talk about the metaverse, right, to get out in front of a crowd that has always been very interested in the new upcoming technology and to pitch kind of his vision for what he wants Meta to build. So I don't know if we're going to be fulfilled as you know, a hard-hitting news journalist from this interview, but I think for him it's a chance to, again, reach people who care about the future of tech with his vision for the future of tech.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll get some probing questions there and maybe some reaction to what my next guest has to say. Kurt Wagner, who covers Meta and Twitter for us. Thank you. Sticking with Meta and its biggest bet on the future, the metaverse, I spoke with former Nintendo America president and COO Reggie Fils-Aimé at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin over the weekend. And I asked him what he thought about Mark Zuckerberg's vision for the evolution of virtual reality. Take a listen to what he had to say.
I'm not a buyer of that idea. I don't think that their current definition is going to be successful.
Why not?
Why do I say that? I say that because first, you know, and I don't know if anyone from Facebook is here, but you have to admit that Facebook itself is not an innovative company.
Wow.
They're not. I mean, you look at, I mean, you look, they have either acquired really interesting things like Oculus, like Instagram, or they've been a fast follower of other people's ideas. That's Facebook. So I inherently, they are not an innovative company other than the very original social platform that was created many years ago.
So what do you think Mark Zuckerberg is getting wrong here?
Well, I believe that in order to be innovative, you really need to be thinking about the consumer first, and I don't think they do. I think you need to be looking at...
What do they think about first?
Well, I think they think about advertising revenue first because that's 98% of their revenue. I mean, that's the fact. But you have to think about your consumer. You have to think about your customer. You need to think about bringing new and different ideas into the marketplace. You need to reward that within your culture. You know, these are the things that drive innovation. You need to have a culture of innovation. Anything that you do within an innovative company, whether you're in accounting, whether you're in product development, whether you're in marketing, you need to be challenging yourself to be doing things differently versus doing the same old, or copying someone else's idea. So, you know, that's why I look at the vision that's been to date articulated, and I'm not a believer. The other thing I would say about Facebook is they don't have a great history with physical products, mm-hmm. right? Portal, you know, not a big idea.
Oculus.
They bought Oculus, mm-hmm. and you know they've been working on it for a number of years. The last number I saw was that in total, and not just Oculus, in total, about 20 million VR devices have been sold. 20 million. You know, when I was running Nintendo, that was a good year, 1 year in terms of hardware.
Hoping we're going to hear Mark Zuckerberg respond to that conversation when he speaks at South by Southwest. Now, my convo with Reggie Fils-Aimé later turned to GameStop. Fils-Aimé joined the GameStop board in April 2020, just months before the state of its roller coaster, start of its roller coaster meme stock ride that saw the stock go from just a few dollars a share to over 500. Fils-Aimé left the board after less than a year, saying he was unhappy with the strategy of chairman of the board, Ryan Cohen. Take a listen.
I asked to be part of the team to develop the strategy. Mm-hmm. I knew the business. I knew it as a consumer. I knew it as a vendor. I had pretty strong opinions on how the business needed to be pivoted. But I was rebuffed, mm-hmm. right? The perspective was, Reggie, we want to keep the team small. And so it's going to be, you know, myself and a few of the people that I brought on board who, you know, by the way, don't know this business, don't understand the players, et cetera, et cetera. I took that as code as, you know, thank you, but we really don't want any other ideas. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was not acceptable.
So what do you think of the strategy now?
There has not been an articulated strategy. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you could go on the GameStop website, try and find a strategy, there is no articulated strategy. Mm-hmm. Leadership says, well, we don't want to articulate our strategy because we don't want anyone to steal our strategy. You know, so I come from the business perspective that you need to articulate your strategy to all of your key constituents. You need to communicate to your business partners, your vendors, your employees, your shareholders. You need to communicate your strategy.
Former Nintendo America president and COO Reggie Fils-Aimé there at South by Southwest in Austin. Coming up, Disney CEO Bob Chapek breaking his silence on the controversial Florida school bill. We'll discuss how it's impacting employees across Disney, Pixar, and more, and what it means for Chapek ahead. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Just 2 years into his role as Disney CEO, Bob Chapek under scrutiny following his response to a controversial Florida school bill. For more, I want to bring in Bloomberg's Chris Palmieri, who covers Disney for us. So, Chris, set the stage. What is this Florida school bill, and why is it so controversial what Bob Chapek didn't and now does have to say about it?
Well, the bill, which was passed by both houses in Florida, would prohibit schools from discussing sexual orientation or gender identity in kindergarten through third grade. This was designed for parents to be able to control the discussion of these issues with their younger kids. A lot of people in the gay community obviously don't like it. It's been called Don't Say Gay. They feel this is really stifling kids who may be just trying to discover where they're going in life. And so Chapek is trying to more broadly sort of keep Disney out of these political topics. He tried to sort of like work behind the scenes on this issue, but not take a public stance, and said that's what he wanted to do going forward. The rank and file at Disney revolted, essentially, openly on social media, employees saying they disagree with this policy, a letter from Pixar employees, animators union, sent out statements, and so Chapek reversed his position a couple of days later on Wednesday of last week, saying, you know, we are openly opposed to this bill, and then a couple of days later even took it further and sort of publicly apologized to all his employees.
A lot of employees were not happy, and you also had leadership within Disney, for example, at Pixar, releasing their own statements. You've got Bob Iger, the former CEO of Disney, also speaking out about this. What do you make of the pushback from other executives?
Well, this is part of a sort of a broader issue that Chapek has found, where he doesn't quite have the same support from the creative community at the company that his predecessor, Bob Iger, did. And so, you know, he's made some decisions that are very unpopular. For example, he's relocating a lot of employees to Florida, you know, that work in theme park design and that from California. They're not happy about being told they have to move. And so we have weird situations now where Florida Governor DeSantis just slammed Disney last week, saying, you know, they don't care about human rights in China. And then Governor Gavin Newsom here in California saying, oh, why are you moving your people to California? So as Chapek predicted, in a way, by taking these political stands, he's opening the company up to firing people attacking them from both sides, it turns
out. This, of course, as Disney shares themselves, have been struggling. Chris Palmieri, who covers Disney for us, will continue to follow here. Meantime, struggling electric car maker Rivian has hired a new COO from Magna, one of the world's biggest automotive suppliers. Frank Klein will take the role on June 1st, Rivian announced Monday, confirming an earlier Bloomberg scoop. Klein led Magna's car making unit before that at Mercedes' parent company at Daimler. 25 years. Rivian stock has been crushed in recent days after the company's forecast building just 25,000 EVs this year, about half what its factory in Illinois is capable of due to a shortage of parts and trouble with production. Rivian's former COO, Rod Corpus, resigned end of last year. Wow. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. The Chinese city of Shenzhen, home to 17.5 million people, is locked down as COVID cases have doubled to roughly 3,400. This as China faces its biggest COVID outbreak since Wuhan in early 2020. Foxconn, Apple's biggest supplier, is now halting operations in Shenzhen, and this could have massive global implications. Our Mark Gurman joining us now with more. Mark, give us a status update on what's happening at Foxconn and what the impacts of this more broadly will be.
So as of now, the office, the main headquarters for Foxconn in Shenzhen, as well as their iPhone factory within Shenzhen, those are both closed right now. Now, Foxconn isn't saying when they're going to be reopening. It is indefinite for now. But the order for closures for factories in other places is in effect in that area until March 20th. So it's possible it'll open around then or after then. But we know the fluidity of COVID and how these things can go on for longer. And that's the real fear here, right? As of now, a week of one iPhone factory being shut down is not going to have much of an impact. This is a slow season for Apple, right? They did just release new products, but they really need the factories running at full steam for the fall and late in the summer for the iPhone 14, new iPads in the fall, augmented reality headsets early next year. That's when it would be danger territory. But right now, I think they're going to be okay, given that their main iPhone plant's called iPhone City is in another region of China, you know, many miles away from here. But we don't know what China's going to do and expand it, right?
Exactly. The pandemic is, I mean, China is hitting a new peak in COVID cases. This is not just happening in Shenzhen. What is Apple doing, or what can Apple do to mitigate this, given that there are already global supply chain issues that have now been reverberating for 2 years?
Yeah, it's very much whack-a-mole, right? Foxconn has many factories across China where they produce the iPhone and other Apple products, right? So as, you know, limitations go up in some factories, right, they'll have to reallocate that to other factories. And as other factories reopen, they'll have to move production back. So I'm sure that's what they're, you know, on the scene in China figuring out right now, right? I think they want to see how bad this becomes. Obviously, we're in a very different place today than we were basically exactly 2 years ago now, with vaccines and masking and people used to these protocols. So my hope, right, not only for, you know, Apple and China, but for globally, that this gets resolved, you know, pretty quickly, and Foxconn is able to work through it at a faster pace than they were able to 2 years ago. If you remember, however, even at the height of the COVID pandemic, Apple really and Foxconn, they were able to figure it out. In the middle of everything, Apple was still able to ship the iPhone 12 in November of 2020, right? That was a two-month delay for their flagship product in the middle of COVID, pre-vaccines, right at the height of things, right? So if they were able to figure it out then with only two-month delays, I'm quite optimistic they'll be able to figure it out with, you know, more vaccines and masking regulations and such at a slower period for the company.
All right, Mark Gurman, we'll continue to watch your reporting on this. Thank you. I want to stay on the topic of COVID and the resurgence we're seeing across China and in Hong Kong and bring in Ali Ehrman. She's a genomics analyst with ARK Invest. You know, Ali, we are seeing the spike in Hong Kong and China as the World Health Organization has been considering declaring an end to the pandemic. Does this signal to you that it could get worse, or maybe a lot worse, before it gets better?
Thanks, Emily, for having me. It's nice to see you again. You know, I think obviously we've had these spikes before. We've seen, you know, multiple mutations arising from COVID-19, and this continues to be an ongoing issue that we're monitoring here at ARK. One of the things that we're thinking about is disruptive technologies that are in our portfolios that could potentially help the crisis. So, you know, one such technology is CRISPR, which is essentially working to look at different cases and potentially being a diagnostic tool, but it's also used as a therapeutic tool as well.
Now, China has had a zero COVID policy, shutting down versus vaccinating on a broad scale. They've been using the Sinovac vaccine when they do vaccinate, but that's a vaccine that doesn't use mRNA technology and appears to be not as effective. Are we seeing that vaccine and that technology breaking down?
It's possible. At ARC, we've been very focused on the mRNA technology. And so we know that we've seen pretty great results from it from the US and also from Israel, where we've gotten a substantial amount of data. And so, you know, this mRNA technology is a novel technology. It hasn't been used prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, we're following very closely what the companies are doing and how they're utilizing that technology, including, you know, Moderna, but also Arcturus Therapeutics. And several other companies that really are focusing, you know, of course, we can talk about Pfizer and the partnerships that they've started there, but also just the amount of sheer data that we're going to get from mRNA and be able to compare that to the adenovirus vaccines as well.
How has the pace of innovation in mRNA and biotechnology accelerated during the pandemic, given the role we've seen it play in vaccinations, along with CRISPR, as you mentioned?
Yeah, so the piece of innovations, Emily, is really interesting because we're seeing that, you know, I think CRISPR is an excellent example, as you mentioned, right? So we're seeing these amazing examples. So prior to CRISPR, you know, zinc finger nucleases, another gene editing form, also TALENs were in existence. And essentially those took a really long time to move from discovery to the first human dose. So that happened for zinc fingers in roughly 8 years, whereas CRISPR took less than half that time. They were about 3 years. They also can target many more unknown diseases. And so what we're seeing is there's a proliferation in terms of the pace of innovation. An example for that could be CRISPR Therapeutics. They're working on creating potentially functional cures for diseases like sickle cell and beta thalassemia. They've treated about 70 patients along with their partner Vertex, both companies within our genomic strategy. And we're seeing the data looks like it could potentially really be a functional cure. And so the pace of innovation, but also what's happening within innovation is really exciting right now.
Meantime, there's a controversy evolving in the gene editing world, which I know that you are following closely, where Nobel Prize winner Jennifer Doudna, who's made important discoveries in mRNA technology and been recognized for her work on CRISPR, has lost a patent dispute surrounding the discovery of her and her team around a specific part of CRISPR technology. What does this mean, and how significant is this?
That's right, Emily. You know, first of all, I think it's great we're talking about this because it demonstrates a commitment from the scientists across the board. It's also quite a complicated topic. So I think it's great to delve in a little bit here. So first of all, what is CRISPR? Maybe we can back up a little bit on that. So CRISPR is a precise tool that is used for gene editing. We believe in it. We've been investing in it for years. We think it's an incredibly innovative tool, and it's revolutionizing the way we think about treatments, but also potential cures. Just a little bit of background here, it's essentially from a family of DNA sequences, and it was found to affect the genomes of bacteria, and it's now potentially using and in trials to be used for correcting genes in humans. So about the patent dispute, as you mentioned. So really quick background here, you know, you covered some of this really helpful. In 2012, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, they wrote a paper, and it detailed the CRISPR system, but they didn't show that it worked in eukaryotic cells. And essentially, Emily, a eukaryotic cell is a cell that has a nuclease. So that could be a plant, and it's also certainly a human. Feng Zhang at Harvard Broad was the first one to do this. So there's essentially two sides, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier on one side that houses that IP from CBC, which is the University of Vienna, also UC Berkeley for both of them. Other side, Feng Zhang, Harvard, and the Broad. So in 2020, as you mentioned, Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna actually won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for their discovery of CRISPR-Cas9. But as you mentioned, this past week, we saw that the USPTO, or US Patent and Trademark Office, did not follow suit. So what does this mean? Getting to the point here, this doesn't stop any ongoing trials. So all clinical trials will continue. It doesn't affect IP outside of the US. The most likely outcome that ARC sees is through some form of cross-licensing among the companies. And in terms of sort of the specifics for companies, so Editas, Verve, and Beam get their IP through Editas or the Broad Harvard, and then CRISPR and Intellia through CBC, so through Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna.
Interesting. A controversy we're going to continue to follow. Jennifer Doudna has been a guest on this show several times. Ali Erman, genomics analyst with ARC Invest, thank you for sharing that background with us. coming up. Ripple calls it a victory. We're going to have more on Ripple's long legal battle with the SEC over alleged illegal sales of its XRP token. What that means for the broader crypto industry next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Time now for our crypto report of the day, and I want to focus on Ripple. After the SEC alleged that the currency exchange platform had engaged in the unlawful offer and sales of securities, its XRP token, Ripple countered, saying they had not had reasonable fair notice from the SEC about whether its sales of XRP were indeed illegal, a defense that the court upheld last week. I want to dig into this with our crypto contributor, Shanali Basik. Shanali, talk to us about how the markets reacted to this news. Obviously, a volatile market and a volatile market for Bitcoin as well.
Yeah, even though we see Ripple down a little bit today, it did really rise after this news. And over the seven-day period, actually, Emily, if you take a look, you do see Ripple rising to the point that it's rising almost twice as much as you see in Bitcoin over that period, and almost three times as you're seeing in Ethereum. So yes, very good news in terms of Ripple and its SEC defense, but there are a lot of questions remaining for the market, not just for Ripple, but the crypto industry here at large. And that question is, as Bloomberg Intelligence calls it, a factual one. Will it cause more issuers to register with the SEC? And what type of regulatory overhang does it leave for the market, even after the Biden executive order that created some clarity for the market?
All right, Shanali, stick with us. We're going to get deeper into this conversation with Ripple CEO himself, Brad Garlinghouse. Brad, good to have you back here on the show. You called this a victory in your battle against the SEC. What does it mean for you and also the broader crypto industry?
Yeah, I do think I'll start there, really. I think it is a victory not just for Ripple, the company, but also the whole crypto industry, because the SEC, I think, has consistently tried to take point and really expand their reach and their control over the crypto industry. We've seen that not just with Ripple, but in other cases. And to have the executive order, as Shanali was talking about, the executive order came out and really said to all agencies, hey, we need to be coordinated. If we want the United States to be competitive in this key technology platform, we need to not have one group behaving one way and another group behaving another way. So we're really pleased by not just the court's decision, but also the executive order that came out last week.
What do you make of the very prominent role that crypto is playing in the war on Ukraine, and also concerns about how cryptocurrency could be used, for example, as a tool to circumvent sanctions by Russians?
You know, Emily, I think this is a bit of a red herring, meaning that there's a lot of attention around it as like, what does this mean? But the practicality of using it to circumvent sanctions, I think, is really difficult. The reality is that if you just take the basic math, before the invasion of Ukraine, there's about $50 billion a day of Russian ruble cross-border FX trades. There's just not enough liquidity in the crypto market to really put much of a dent in that. Moreover, you know, the point at which sanctions are applied is at the endpoint. So through, you know, exchanges, a Bitstamp or a Binance. And I think you've seen globally that the major exchanges around the world say, hey, we're going to acknowledge, enforce, and respect those sanctions. And so I think that the idea that crypto is being used at any scale to circumvent sanctions is not a really it doesn't really understand how some of this stuff works.
On one hand, you do have plenty of exchanges that seem to be working with the Biden administration to kind of figure out what's going on under the surface in the market. But on the other hand, when it comes to the SEC, it seems like they've been at the crosshairs of a number of different firms. Do you think the SEC is taking a tougher stance than the administration at large? And do you think that will hinder at all some of the progress that some firms are making?
Look, I think there's no question that the United States Securities and Exchange Commission has reduced the competitiveness of this critical industry in the United States. I think they've been out of step, not just with other parts of the U.S. government, but they've been out of step with other major economies around the world. The only country in the world that considers XRP, the digital asset that Ripple uses in our technology stack, the only country in the world that thinks XRP could be a security is the United States. We work successfully in the UK, in Switzerland, in Japan, in the UAE, in Singapore. All of these countries have acknowledged XRP as a currency because that's how it's used. So I think the way the U.S., if we want the U.S. to be a leader in this new, growing, critical, innovative industry like the Internet 20 years ago, we need that regulatory clarity. And the SEC is really just coming out and saying, we're going to file lawsuits, enforcement. We're not going to provide clear rules so that people know how to operate as other countries have done.
All right. Brad Garlinghouse, CEO of Ripple. Brad, always good to have you with us. And our Shanali Basak, thanks. We'll continue to follow your situation with the SEC. CNN is preparing to launch its most ambitious effort yet, a new streaming service, CNN Plus. Why will consumers buy in when there's a sea of other streaming options? Here's what Andrew Moore, CNN Executive Vice President, who's leading the streaming effort, had to say.
I think at our heart, we have always been about the news. And I think every news organization, you know, in the United States tends to do a bit of a rethink every political cycle. That's natural because politics becomes such an important coverage area for everybody. So I don't think that's unusual for any news organization to think about, okay, what's next? And especially now, by the way, at a time when the entire industry is moving quickly, at a time when the entire industry is being disruptive, I think it's logical.
There's been a lot of controversy surrounding Jeff Zucker's abrupt departure not long after Chris Cuomo's exit, tied in part to Chris interviewing his brother, the governor of New York, on air. You've seen all the criticism. What's your view on what happened?
It's a good question, Emily. what is my view? Look, when I heard about Jeff's resignation, I was shocked. We were all shocked. It was a very hard day for CNN. You know, Jeff resigned, and in his resignation, Jeff said that he was resigning because he did not disclose a relationship that he had with a colleague. And that was, his departure was very hard on the whole organization. Mm-hmm. And we've all been doing our best to lead through, you know, a pretty difficult period with Jeff's departure.
Some of CNN's own stars have pushed back on the way this was handled. Dana Bash said at an internal meeting reportedly that the punishment didn't fit the crime. Did you think the punishment fit the crime?
You know, I think the rules apply to everybody. And the fact is, you know, the three red and white letters of CNN matter a lot, and they're bigger than any of us.
Meantime, shareholders have given Discovery's merger with HBO and CNN parent Warner Media the green light. Discovery CEO David Zaslav naming Chris Licht to president of CNN at the South by Southwest Festival. I spoke with Andrew Morse more in depth about the future of CNN Plus, the network's new streaming service and its most ambitious effort since the network's launch. Take a listen.
The beauty of a subscription service is if you create something of value, people will pay. You walk into a supermarket, you walk into a mall, you walk into a shop, you go online. If there's something of value, you'll pay. And when you think about what CNN does, you think about the coverage that we have in the Ukraine, you think about the depth of knowledge that Sanjay Gupta has and the role that he's played in this country in terms of informing, you know, informing people about COVID in the last year, we are so confident that we're building something of such value that people are going to be willing to give up one cup of coffee a month to pay for this service.
just in time for your appearance here today, shareholders approved the merger of Discovery and Warner Media. CNN has a new president. Chris Licht has been named. Helped conceive Morning Joe, produce The Colbert Show, revamp CBS. Have you met with Chris Licht, and what has he told you he wants to see from CNN Plus?
So we haven't been able to talk to him yet. And in fact, even though the Discovery shareholders have voted, we're in a quiet period. So we actually haven't been able to formally meet with Discovery about our business plans for a while. But look, I've gotten to know Chris over the years. He is, what I do know of him, he's an incredibly creative producer. He's a great journalist. He's somebody who really knows what an organization like CNN needs to be successful.
What's the budget for CNN Plus? How much have you spent so far?
It is by orders of magnitude larger than anything CNN has taken on really since the network was founded. It's a very serious undertaking, and it requires significant investment. But the reason for the significant investment is it's tied to a very aggressive and ambitious business plan. We feel very, very confident that we're going to be able to grow a very substantial subscriber base pretty quickly. And so we've been able to put together a business plan and an investment case that gets us to a place where we think we can build a very healthy business.
Given all the numbers you've run, the research you've done, when then do you expect this bet to pay off?
Well, we think it can become profitable within a few years. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the beauty of a subscription business, mm-hmm. and I come back to that every time. You know, it's what makes it different from cable television. It's what makes it different from advertising. If you build something of value and you deliver value to the customers and you put those customers before anything else, you can build a business. And you have to back it up. You have to have a great product. You have to have great content. You have to have great talent. You can't be afraid to pivot. You can't be afraid to, you know, to continue to take chances. But you know, we feel good about what we're building.
Andrew Morris, Executive Vice President of CNN, speaking at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. CNN Plus launches March 29th. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Tomorrow, we're going to be joined by Reshma Chowdhury, founder of Girls Who Code. She's out with a brand new book on the future of women and work. Also, Joseph Lubin to talk about all things crypto, the CEO of Consensus and the co-founder of Ethereum. That's tomorrow right here on Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang. This is Bloomberg.